morning, Sunday, November 27th, 2011. Hope you had a happy Thanksgiving. Good Rosh Chodesh Kislev. Hanukkah's coming up soon. Mm-hmm. Happy birthday, Ed.
Thank you.
So today in Confronting Chosenness, we're starting it with rabbinic perspectives. We spent the past 4 weeks or so discussing biblical sources, and today we move into things from the rabbinic period. Just a few words as an introduction in terms of methodology here. When we look at the rabbinic sources, there are really, hundreds that are going to be relevant. We're clearly not going to be doing all. Every now and again, I'm going to organize the discussion based on another work. Today it'll be based on Ephraim Orbach's The Sages, Their Concepts and Beliefs, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. But one big thing that I think we need to keep in mind today is historical context, and is that going to matter? The reason is this. When we spend time in the Bible, we can assume, yes, there have been, the Bible takes place, the narratives in the Bible over several hundred years, sometimes more than that, actually, obviously, several hundred still counts as more than that. But the voice of God, we are going to assume, is somehow unchanging and is going to be eternal. When you're dealing with the rabbinic sages, you're dealing with people, you're dealing with men. And there's a bit of a, you can approach this from two different perspectives. Either that what they are representing is part of one big, unified, cohesive whole, not unlike a perception of the Bible, or are they in fact responding to events and scenarios in their time and place? And that's going to affect how we read these sources. And the truth is, for this particular series of Confronting Chosenness, if you ask, does historical context matter, the answer is it really depends. From an academic perspective, the answer is always, because you're going to want to know, why were these statements made? If it was in response to something, try to figure out, where did this come from? Maybe it wasn't a purely completely unbiased read of the text that, in a vacuum, as opposed to, they're actually trying to affect a certain change in the society, or they're trying to protect something based on whatever else is going on around them. The reason why you might think it doesn't matter is that whether or not the sages actually did respond to a social reality, is that the way that we today, or rabbis in previous generations, looked at these sources? Meaning, if the rabbinic sources are going to be somehow foundational for Jewish thought, theology, and law, then it doesn't necessarily matter for later generations whether or not this was Tanaitic, Amoraic, or whether or not there was a shift. You just point to and say, such and such, here's where it is, and it's all part of this giant compendium. So that is something important to consider. Additionally, there are difficulties in terms of exactly dating when stuff was said. Professor Jacob Neusner is particularly skeptical on any attribution, whether or not, let's say Rav Meir says X, Y, or Z, whether or not the individual Rav Meir actually said that. There's a bit of a debate in academic circles. So we'll try to keep in mind, at least for this class, and I might go back and forth depending on, what source I use to combine stuff together. But today we're going to keep somewhat in mind, if not of the specific person, at least eras, meaning of Tanaitic or Amoraic, period of the Tanaim, Second Temple period, a little bit later, and the Amoraic period, would end, around, let's say, 500, give or take. So there's a huge range there. And some of the sources here could be, I'll use an idiom of, this is relatively early or relatively late. One thing where you can find something interesting, though, is if a certain idea only appears in a Tanaitic source and doesn't appear elsewhere in Amoraic, maybe that can tell you something about a shifting thought, or if it didn't appear in the early one, but it does appear later. If you're trying to argue like that, you can say it's an argument from silence, which doesn't mean that people didn't think that, it just means it wasn't recorded. Today we'll see certain things that, you know, conflicting ideas that may appear in similar time periods in a somewhat of a vague sense. So that's just a few words on the methodology and how this is going to play out. Sometimes it's going to matter, sometimes not. It really is going to depend on what are the questions you're asking and the information you're trying to draw out of it. Today, it's not going to matter as much, but it's something we'll keep in mind. And the question that we're going to address today is, in the general sense of the selection of Israel, in terms of us being the chosen people, whether it is a cosmic selection or a conditional selection. The difference with cosmic is God actually sort of, you know, chose the Jewish people independently of anything else that we did. It was somehow part of the divine plan. And that would also speak to the immutability of the Jews being the chosen people, because it's one thing to say that we were chosen because we did something. It's another way to say this: the entire existence of the world was either predicated on us being chosen, or our chosenness was predicated on the whole part of the world. It's just, it had to have happened. The world could not have existed in any other way.
It's a Rashi on Bereishis, I think, something about the world was created for the Jews. Pretty outrageous. But.
Well, we'll see different, you know, we'll see variants on that theme in section one. Section two expresses chosenness as a function of, well, we did something, in which case there's that element of conditional aspect to it. And it's an important distinction to make. Ephraim Rohrbach, when he, you know, writes about this in the book, you know, does address certain issues of polemic. In that, you know, if one group is saying, well, you weren't the ones chosen by God, or somehow, well, you gave up on it, you start having teachings that say, well, really, you know, this is an internal thing. And we saw enough texts in the Tanakh that would, that do stress the eternality of the relationship between God and the Jewish people, which is, you know, different slightly than saying that it is cosmic, in that, you know, it's part of the natural. But at any rate, that's going to be the theme for today. Let's start. Ed, this is a Mechilta Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, considered, you know, a midrashic text attributed to Shimon Bar Yochai, early Tana. So, take the English here. This is from the Mechilta, chapter 14.
The Jews were recalled before the 6 days of creation.
Right, Kfar Mus Karim Heim, Livnei Mishesha Et Yimei Bereishit. Right, clearly giving an early sense of, you know, the Jews were, you know, were called, or really was covering, you know, either remembered, technically mentioned, at least the thought of the Jewish people predated even creation. Right, take source number two. This is Mishnah Avot 3:14.
Rabbi Akiva used to say, "Beloved is the man that he was created in the image of God. Extra love is made known to him that he was created in God's image. As is said, for in his own image God made humankind. Beloved to the Jews that they are called sons to God. An extra love is made known to them that they are called sons to God. As it is said, you are children of the Lord your God. Beloved are the Jews that there has been given to them the precious instrument. An extra love is made known to them that they were given the precious instrument of the world's creation. As it says, or I give you good precepts, do not forsake my teaching."
All right, so you could interpret this. One second. Wow, well, this is actually kind of interesting here, because there's actually a slightly different text here. Interesting. Looking at a different gersa here, and it says this last thing of Shinitalam Klicham Deshaboni for Ha'olam doesn't seem to appear in other versions of this Mishnah, which I didn't notice before. So let's actually put a pause on that. I might have to take that one out altogether and give it more research. I knew the translation was off, but I didn't realize that the text was off too. All right, so let's actually put a pin in that. Might actually remove it completely. Let's move on to Dvarim. Sorry, move on to source three. This is, first there's the Pasuk in Devarim 7:6, and then Sifrei 97 on that. So take it again, since we're going to pretend that that one doesn't exist for today.
For you, people holy to the Lord your God, the Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on earth and the face of the earth to be his people, his cherished, treasured possession.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are a holy nation to God, make yourselves holy. because you are holy to God, the holiness which is on you causes you to be. Another explanation, it does not rot give rise to other nations to be as holy as you. And you have been chosen by God because Jacob chose you to be God, to be a treasured nation, Israel for his treasure. And God chose you to be his treasured nation from all other nations. This teaches that each individual as Jew is more precious to God than all the other nations of the world. One may think that this started with the forefathers. Thus we are taught from all the nations on the face of the earth, meaning from before and after, and not just from the times of the forefathers.
So this is a really rich sifre. Yeah. It's an anonymous sifre, but the sifre is considered to be a Tanaitic, a relatively early source here. So just notice a few points here. One, you have a reaffirmation of our chosenness. Two, it doesn't give rise to other nations to be as holy as you, meaning there is a certain national superiority. Then there is that same in here, milamed shekol echad ve'echad chaviv lifnei kadosh baruch hu mikol umot ha'olam. Right? It's a pretty big statement to say that one Jew is somehow more desired or more precious to God than entire nations. We're probably going to, quote the source, later in terms of how do we contrast ourselves with the other nations of the world. But there's, this is a fairly elitist type of statement. For the purposes of this discussion, as I underlined the last lines here, Talmud Lomar Mikol Amim Asher Al Pnei Adama Amor Me'ata Shelefanav Milisha Achar. Me'ata Shelefanav Lacharav Lo Me'avot Rishonim. That you might think that it started from the forefathers, but then we're taught that it is from all the nations of the faces of the earth, meaning before and after, not just from the times of the forefathers. This speaks to, one second, a certain eternality of this, selection and this really sense of elitism, that it's not just a matter of God, spoke to Avram first and that's what really set it off. According to the Sifre, this is part of the natural order of the world and how God created things, such that we were already predestined to be selected, even before, the forefathers came to being. Yeah.
Two comments on that. First, if the Goyim ever got their hands on this particular page, it would cause a lot of anti-Semitism, as though none exists already, but this is asking for it.
We'll be dealing with that a bunch, certainly in subsequent weeks. And that's not an incorrect, statement here. I mean, if you go to, there are a few anti-Semitic websites that do pick out
stuff like this.
Maybe not this itself, because, the Sifre, even though it's an important source, isn't really that well read. But we'll find other stuff, say, in the Babylonian Talmud, which has been studied a lot more and is a lot more accessible, that has stuff, kind of like this. And it's one of the things that we're going to be keeping in mind. And in fact, one of the things that we're going to try to address here, are there going to be sources that we're going to find that today might make, a liberal feel very uncomfortable? Absolutely. But we can't pretend that they don't exist. The question is, what do we do with them? Now, when you take a passage like this, you can take it in a few different ways. You can either say, one, this is literal God's truth, and we, in fact, are superior to all other non-Jews. That's one approach. Another approach is, perhaps there is another intent going on behind it. Meaning, given that this was written by this passage here, in terms of this rabbinic teaching, was in fact written or recorded down by humans, maybe it reflects something of that time and place where they happen to have been. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's where the historical context does, is important. Or to put it another way, the text says what it does. Right? And we're not going to argue on, yes, the text does say this, but what does it mean for our own sense of, theology? Also, we're going to see, this is only section one. When I put here cosmic or conditional, there are two sections. One is cosmic, the other is conditional, which means we are going to find other sources in rabbinic texts, and in fact in the Sifre itself, I believe, that would actually contradict this idea. So if you cherry pick certain things that someone might, find offensive, yes, they're there, but to what extent do you give one source greater weight over contradictory evidence? And that's partially methodological and partially going to be polemical. Meaning, if I'm going to be in a certain, you know, environment quoting one, like, I could quote the exact same, you know, body of text and come up with something completely different. You cited Rashi earlier. Rashi as a commentator is really unoriginal. About 95 to 98% of Rashi is citing rabbinic midrashim very selectively. If you take other midrashim, like from the same book of, you know, same textbooks, book of texts, I should say, that Rashi had in front of him, you could come out with a really, really different commentary and a whole lot of different implications on what the Bible means. So,
second,
yeah.
Second comment is this real recent exchange for Gilad Shalit.
Mm.
I don't know how many Arab terrorists were traded. I forget. 100,000.
Mm.
That's like what's inspired by stuff like this, that one Jew is worth more than 1,000 Arabs. You know, it's
that's, you know, I don't think that that was the mentality of, you know, how people approach it. That is an interesting approach. I don't think that this mentality was what was driving the negotiations.
Yeah, but I think the negotiations were definitely an error. I mean, those terrorists can cause a lot of more military damage than...
that is a position that many share for a whole lot of reasons. I am not even touching that because it's well above my pay grade. We discussed it in the shul a bit in terms of like some of the halachic ramifications of, you know, terrorist exchange. And it is incredibly complicated. And I am personally very grateful that I am not the one who has to make these decisions. Mm. Moving on, Bereishit Rabbah 1:4. So Bereishit Rabbah is itself a strange text in terms of dating. It is a the Midrashei Rabbah are compilations of earlier homiletic teachings. That even though it was compiled certainly after, you know, people can have like Tanitic as well as Amoraic statements in there or people in there as well. So in terms of the actual compilation, honestly, not entirely sure. But it is one of the later Midrashic compilations. It says, in the beginning, you know, God created. So we're talking about the first, you know, Pasuk on Bereishit Bara'elokim. So, Shisha Dvarim Kidmu L'Briyat Ha'olam. That there were six things that preceded the creation of the world. Yesh Behem Shenivra'u V'yesh Mehem She'alu B'machshava L'Hibara'ot. Some of them were actually created before the creation of the world, and some things, even if they weren't actually created, the consideration was for them to be created. So, alright, turn page. Alright, so skipping ahead, the Torah and the throne of glory were created. The Torah, for it is written, the Lord made me the beginning of his way, prior to the works of old. The throne of glory, as it is written, the throne established of old, etc. The creation of the patriarchs was contemplated, for it is written, I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first season, citing a verse from Hosea 9:10. And the creation of Israel was contemplated, as it is written, remember the congregation which thou hast gotten aforetime, Zechor Edetecha Kinyat Kedem, meaning Kedem indicating something that happened earlier. According to this Midrash and Bereishit Rabbah, it would actually meant that the creation of the Jewish people, even if they weren't actually created before creation, because that would have meant you would have had a bunch of individuals flying in space and, you know, probably, you know, getting whatever in a vacuum. But there was at least some, you know, cosmic thought to create the forefathers and the Jewish people. So according to these, you know, first few sources here, there does seem to be, and again, just to prove this point, there is in rabbinic texts or attributed rabbinic or certain texts attributed in the rabbinic period, even though the Sifrei was anonymous, but there are rabbinic texts that do indicate or seem to imply that God's choosing of the Jewish people or the Jewish people as a chosen nation is a cosmic universal designation that can even predate, you know, the creation, which is, I mean, we can discuss that idea.
Does it even make sense? I mean, if you assume a God beyond time, does it even make sense to say God did X and then did God thought Y, or God thought X and then thought Y?
True, but you can view it in contrast to this. View it in contrast as opposed to saying, you know, how do things work, assuming as God is a non-linear being, mm-hmm. so it wouldn't necessarily matter. But from our perspective as humans, mm-hmm. it sure would, because it takes out the entire matter of choice, mm-hmm. right? So if you think that, you know, we were chosen because, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, like you want to say that, you know, God's choosing of Abraham was arbitrary, mm-hmm. well, according to this, it wasn't arbitrary. It always had to be this way. Mm-hmm. You want to say...
if Abraham would have said, shove it back
well,
to God...
Well, because apparently it wasn't going to happen. Well, it does set up. I mean, anyone here into science fiction? And I know it's a huge... I mean, yeah, it's weird. Talk about rifts in the space-time continuum about how things work and, you know, did it always have to be this way?
Not to mention free will and predestination.
Exactly. Free will, predestination are huge here. And also, could it ever be undone? Meaning, if this was part of the cosmic plan, you're basically saying this is the way the world absolutely had to be. And it puts the Jewish people... or at least as I see it, as really the center of the creation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing to say that we earn our role for doing one thing or another, which, you know, we saw enough, you know, sources, you know, in the Torah. Well, the truth is, in the Torah, just the biblical verses, we saw a little bit of both. We saw one from God choosing Abraham, and that really setting things up that was unconditional. We saw a lot that was conditional of, you know, we have this relationship to keep the mitzvot. But you're setting, you know, so by focusing on this, you're... by focusing on the eternality and the cosmic part, you're effectively saying that the world could not have existed except in such and such a way, putting the Jewish people, you know, really at the center of the universe. Right? Now, I consider this to be theologically significant. And sure, we can take these in a whole lot of different directions, but it is important to know that these sources do in fact exist within, you know, the rabbinic corpus. Even if you want to, you know, dismiss Bereishit Rabbah for one reason, I mean, you do have the Sefer, you have the Mechilta, so it's there. Mm-hmm. However, there are also other, you know, sources that might seem to contradict, including things that involve conditional selection. Let me take this one. This is from Devarim HaZinu 3:12. There's a discussion of Kichalak Shemimo, that the portion of the Lord is his people. Gives the Midrasher gives a mashal. Again, this is the Sifrei, earlier Talmudic source. This case is comparable to that of a king who has a field, which he leased to tenant farmers. The tenants began to steal from it, so he took it from them and gave it to their sons. They soon proved themselves worse than the first. He thereupon took it away from their sons and gave it to their grandsons, but they showed themselves to be even worse. When, however, a son was born to him, he said to the tenants, "Go forth from my land, you cannot remain there. Give me back my portion so that I may declare it to be mine." Even so, when our father Abraham came into the world, there issued, sorry, that's my typo, from him the refuse of Ishmael and all the sons of Keturah. When Isaac came into the world, there issued from him the refuse of Esau and all the chiefs of Edom, and they were even worse than the first. When Jacob, however, arrived, no refuse issued from him, but all the sons born to him were worthy, as it is said, "And Jacob was a perfect Tam man dwelling in tents." Who is the first person claimed by the omnipotent as his portion, his chelek? For it is said, "For the portion of the Lord is his people, and Jacob the lot of his inheritance." And it is further, "For the Lord has chosen Jacob." So this is an interesting switch here, in that the chosenness thing isn't just on Abraham, but it's actually seems to focus on Yaakov. But the matter still remains ambiguous, and we cannot tell whether the Holy One, blessed be He, chose Jacob, or whether Jacob chose the Holy One, blessed be He. Therefore, the Scripture teaches us Israel for his own treasure. However, the matter is still undecided, and we do not know if the Holy One, blessed be He, chose Israel for his own treasure, or if Israel chose the Holy One, blessed be He. Therefore, Scripture teaches, "And the Lord God hath chosen thee to be his own treasured people." And how do we know that Jacob also chose the Lord? For it is said, "Not like these is the portion of Jacob." According to this, I mean, it basically, you know, states that, you know, it sort of sets it up as both. The question raised is almost artificial. Did God choose the Jews, or did Jews choose God? The answer seems to be both. And it doesn't seem to say here whether or not which came first, and it doesn't seem to matter. Mm-hmm. What does seem to matter is that the choosing of the Jewish people wasn't something necessarily cosmic, but it was something that actually had to be actively done. Mm-hmm. Meaning it's one thing to say that God created the world and knew that such and such was going to happen, but once God actually has to go through some choosing process, again, thinking, you know, in a human linear mm-hmm. concept here, from the moment of choice, right, before that we weren't chosen, after that we were. And that there is that fixed point in time when our status kind of shifts, implication being without that action of choosing, we would not have been God's chosen people. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay. It takes far, this is Sefrei Devarim, 96:14.
Children are you to the Lord your God. Deuteronomy 14:1.
Mm-hmm.
Reb Yehuda says, if you act in the manner of children, then you will be my children. And if not, you are no longer my children. Reb Meir says, in either case, you were children before God, for it says the number of the children of Israel cannot be counted. Hosea 2:1.
Okay, any thoughts on this?
Well, that seems to be a pretty clearly contrasting perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly between Rabbi Yehuda and Rav Meir, because Rabbi Yehuda is the one who sets up a clear condition. Im nohagim atem min hagbanim, harei atem banim. Ve'im lav, I atem banim. Meaning it's up to you. I mean, your status as children, you know, God's children, well, you know, that's up to what you do. Mm-hmm. Suppose it's not unlike, you know, if you have, you know, someone who has kids, you know, someone does something wrong. It's like, look at what your son did. It's like, because, you know, it's not my son. It's like, look at what your kid did. Like, okay. And Rav Meir says, you know, in either case, you know, it doesn't matter. Now, that doesn't necessarily speak, at least, you know, Rav Meir, you might say, goes either way in terms of whether or not it was cosmic or not, you know, or some after effect of chosenness. But according to Rav Yehuda, there seems to be some condition attached,
mm-hmm.
which, as you said, is a contrasting perspective. Also in the Sefrei, that, you know, this is Sefrei 96, which is only one paragraph above what we saw in Sefrei 97 on the first page of the source sheet here. Mm-hmm. Right? So even within a relatively early Tannaitic source, you find, you know, differences, a significant difference of opinion. This is where historical context matters in a sense, because you do have within a relatively similar time period, two contrasting ideas and two contrasting approaches to the very same question. Now, does that mean one is right or one is wrong? I'm not sure how you could evaluate that. I mean, again, you're talking about individuals who are trying to either, you know, trying to understand the divine, either, you know, meditatively or textually trying to figure out, well, what do these verses mean, while they're also trying to respond to very real challenges in their day.
Mm-hmm.
Teek. All right. Well, I guess in a somewhat of a similar, I guess we should, I probably can combine the two. Take the next one. Source number 7. This is kind of related, I suppose. This is a Sefrei Devarim 308.
Corrupt are they, and not as children. Even though they are full of defects, they are called children. These are the words of Rav Meir, who there it says, Banav Mumam. Rav Yehuda says, they have no flaws, as it says, Lo Banav Mumam. And it similarly says, a sinful nation, a people loaded with guilt, a brood of evildoers, children given to corruption. If when they are corrupt, they are called children. When they are not corrupt, how much more so?
So this is a fascinating, almost weird reversal of the previous source. Right? Look at Rabbi Yehuda, you know, being the operative one. In Sefer A, 96, he says, if you act in the manner of children, you will be my children, if not, not. Here he says, Shichet lo, lo banav mumam. Says really it means here that they have no flaws. And, you know, similarly it says, sinful nation loaded with guilt and corruption, evildoers, you know, children given to corruption. And then seems to continue, in ke mashchitim kiruim banim, if when they are corrupt they are still called children, iluloya mashchitim alachat kama vechama. Seems to contrast exactly what he said immediately, you know, well, not immediately before, but in the previous passage.
Yeah.
again, you know, these are some of the methodological questions you're going to have to deal with the rabbinic sources. You may not even find internal consistency, or you're going to have to harmonize internal consistency, or say that, you know, maybe it wasn't actually Rabbi Yehuda, or, you know, it's referring to someone else. At any rate, something important to consider. Gemara Nechagiga 3a. Kodarsh further expounded on thou hast vouched for the Lord this day. Hashem marta hayom, Hashem mircha hayom. Amar lehem Hakadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael. God tells the Jewish people, Atem asituni chativa achat ba'olam, that you have made me a unique object of your love in the world. Va'ani esa etchem chativa achat ba'olam, and I will make for you a unique object of love in my world. Right. This would seem to, you know, has a certain sense of our relationship with God is dependent on our choice. Again, the implication being, if we did not, then we wouldn't have been. Perhaps the most explicit, I shouldn't say most explicit, but, you know, another explicit source about the conditional aspect, at take, this is 9. This is Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael, and also an early Tanaitic source, Mishpatim chapter 20.
And you will be holy before me, Shmuel 22:30. Reb Yishmael said, when you are holy, you will be mine.
She'atem kedoshim, on the pasuk, anshe kadosh tihiuli, you will be holy, kesha'atem kedoshim, hare'atem shali. It's only when, in fact, you are holy and sanctified, that's when you're going to be mine. All right? So, just from, you know, the few sources that we saw today, there seems to be at least, you know, two trains of thought in terms of the Jewish people's selection. Whether or not it's cosmic, whether or not it's eternal, whether or not it was, you know, to use a, you know, Doctor Who reference, a fixed, you know, like, well, it's used the term fixed point, or solid time, wherever it works. But that there was no other choice, that this was primordial in a way. And the whole sense of choosing almost doesn't enter into it, and that this is just the way that God set up the world. Another approach seems to be that our relationship with God, in terms of being special in some way, now it doesn't mean rejected completely in terms of the brief, but whatever special status we have does seem to be, at least certain status, seems to be conditional based on a couple of sources, be it a matter of whether or not we're considered God's children, whether or not we are considered kadosh, is not, even if we may be on the whole chosen by God in some sense, the nature of the relationship is still subject to change. Now, it's possible that we can actually harmonize it in that way, to say, yes, on the global cosmic level, we are chosen by God, but that doesn't mean that we're immune. And it doesn't mean, as you remarked earlier, that sense of elitism from the very beginning, that we're worth more, that's actually something that's permanent. Maybe that's just one way things are set up, but that doesn't mean that we get off scot-free, you know. Like, sometimes if you have, like, a parent, a family, when you've got a bunch of children, and, you know, one of them is the favorite, so, you know, you let the favorite, you know, child, you know, get off, you know, get away with a whole lot more stuff than you would with the other one. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I guess things can change. You know, when you're talking about the Jewish people, at least, I don't know the sources where, in the rabbinic sources, where the special designation of the Jewish people as chosen actually is rejected. And so we saw there are far too many biblical verses that would counteract that. But there does seem to be, how to put this, if you only focus on that, you could lead to, you know, as Ed said, a certain degree of elitism that makes it, if this is true, then no matter what we do, we're always going to be chosen by God, and we're always going to be held in God's esteem. And you can understand why, on one hand, thinking, you know, focusing on the cosmic part can be very inspirational, can be something that is therapeutic in some ways, something that you can rely on, something that can be, you know, a source of spiritual basis. At the same time, it could also lead you into arrogance. And in some ways, I think you may need to have that idea tempered practically, again, trying to communicate with people to say, well, yes, you are chosen by God, but that doesn't mean you can just, you know, kick up on the beach and not do anything. Mm-hmm. That there still has to be that element that is earned. Mm-hmm. And the way that I understand this, just a personal understanding, is that this actually contrasts sort of the biblical dichotomy between God choosing Abraham kind of out of the blue and the covenant that we made with God, that you do have both elements, and trying to strike that balance of, on one hand, having faith that the Jews as chosen people is eternal, but at the same time, not letting it go to your head and realizing that there is another component that we need to constantly earn at the same time.
The Christians are making the argument that God chose the Jews, but he switched horses after a certain point and went over to the Christians.
So my understanding is that different Christian denominations would actually, you know, give various nuanced approaches to how did another selection happen. There's no doubt that Christians actually say that. And, you know, from the Jewish perspective, you could also understand why certain sources might, you know, at certain times, people might want to focus on, well, the, whatchamacallit, might want to emphasize the eternality of the covenant with the Jewish people, specifically to contrast with, you know, Christian sects that might say otherwise. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you also, like I said, you know, don't want people to get too full of themselves either, and you still want to maintain some level of obedience. And it's, you know, sort of a subtle, you know, a subtle line to follow. And, you know, given that the sources that, you know, we read here span several hundred years, it's hard to, you know, view it as just a pure, oh, it's either this or that. I'm trying to explain that both types of sources appear in rabbinic literature. Here are some ways of understanding why and what might be some reasons for people giving these teachings that might be, say, more practical than theological. Is one of them right or wrong in some objective sense? It's kind of hard to say. I think, you know, if you're viewing it from a historical perspective, you know, there's no way to know, and there's absolutely no way to verify. And we can also argue whether or not that was the intent. What I'd like to suggest is whether or not this was actually how the history happened. There is truth in both. And, you know, and truth is somewhat different than saying historical fact. To quote Niels Bohr, the opposite of, you know, the line, the opposite of a true statement is a false statement. The opposite of a profound truth may very well be another profound truth. And, that's going to be more of, you know, the approach here, because there's no way to know exactly, you know, what God did, because no one lived there. You're trying to understand things in retrospect based on how you understand texts, based on the teachings that you've received, and just based on how you view the world. But that doesn't, even though you've got two ideas that seem to contrast, from a logical perspective, they may be mutually exclusive from one perspective, if it's either this or that. They don't necessarily have to be.
And just as one way to harm, maybe partially harm, is that the cosmic, most of the cosmic statements seems to be about the beginning of the covenant, saying that the beginning of the covenant was in some way predestined.
Mm-hmm.
I think that certainly could be in some way true. I mean, even if you say, well, Abraham made a free choice, still, he must have been put in somehow, he must have been in an environment where somehow the idea would have come to him. You know, and it's just that, or Abraham or Yaakov or whatever. But on the other hand, the choices emphasizing conditionality tend to be more about post-Moses. Basically about, you know, now that we have this covenant, how do we handle it?
Yeah, we'll see that with Kephel Amharka Gigit. That's going to come up a little bit later in terms of, you know, was the choice at Har Sinai really a choice?
Right, I'm evading Sinai. I'm talking about, you know, in the 3,000 years after Sinai, I think later sources are saying, you know,
perhaps. The truth is, I mean, this is a selection. I mean, really, to answer a lot of these questions, authoritatively, would have to go through every single rabbinic source,
right,
which we clearly don't have time to do. It would be great. I mean, I thought about doing a Gemara here, but there was no interest in doing straight Gemara, so... I don't know. I have to do a lot more research in terms of saying, is that really the pattern that's going on? I don't know. And there's a lot out there and a lot buried in a lot of sources for me to say one way or the other. So I can't comment on that. Maybe it could also just be happens, you know, from the sources that I happen to have dug up for this particular class. Didn't occur to me otherwise. All right. Excellent. So have a wonderful week. And for those interested in the Tuesday class on Fundamentals of Judaism, we'll be starting off with the foundations of rabbinic authority and slowly get into how halacha works. So if you're interested, that's Tuesday night at 8. And have a great day and a great chodesh.
Yeah.